So how much of the past is really in the past? Are we responsible for crimes committed by our ancestors? How much progress have humans really made? A new novel tackles these questions by mixing fact and fiction. Darwin's Ghost is Ariel Dorfman's first novel in 17 years. He's an Argentine-Chilean-American novelist, playwright, academic, human rights advocate, and so much more. Ariel has been described as one of the finest voices in contemporary Latin American storytelling. His works have been translated into more than 50 languages. Darwin's Ghost is a story of a man whose distant heritage comes back to haunt him and eventually leads him to investigate the 19th century kidnappings of indigenous peoples for use in human zoos. Ariel, thank you for joining us. Your book is beautifully written, but also deeply disturbing.
Well, I want it to be disturbing, and I want it to be beautiful, so thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here in New York, which, of course, is my hometown, because I was brought up as a kid here when my parents had to flee Argentina when I was 2.5 years old. So it's very good to be here. Thank you for having me.
We love having you here. So the inspiration for Darwin's Ghosts, where did it come from?
Well, you know, all my books start from a tiny experience. Generally, in my head, there are seething hundreds and hundreds of ideas, characters, possibilities, words. But one day I was sitting waiting to have my photograph taken for this TSA thing, you know. My wife was inside. She went first. And I thought to myself, what would happen if when they take this photograph, instead of me, somebody else appeared? Perhaps a gorilla appeared or somebody else, I mean, or a criminal. And they said, oh, we got you, you know? So I just thought about that idea. And when I went in, they took the photograph. And of course, it was me on there. But it kept on percolating in my head and turning over and over again. And I had been interested in human zoos for a while, meaning these are this was a phenomenon which is similar in popularity and spectacularity to what we have as reality shows today, you could say. There was no television. There was hardly any radio back there in the 19th century.
But these zoos, people were treated like animals. Well, they weren't allowed to live.
They were kidnapped from their native lands in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, even Plains Indians here in the United States. And they were brought to be exhibited at zoos in cages very often.
Naked.
And often experimented on by doctors scientifically to find out if they were the missing link or not in the Darwinian evolutionary scale. So it was a terrible crime committed, and some of these people died. Some went back to their native lands. Some even stayed here and made a... Now, Otabenga was here. He was put in the chimpanzee here at the Bronx Zoo. He was put in a cage, and they would throw things at him and throw bananas at him and things like that. So there was this crime committed. And what I was most interested in was two things. One was, who photographed these people? Somebody photographed these people. And then, who captured them? Who brought them from their native lands? Who uprooted them and exhibited them for everybody to see? And the real question for our times is, think about the fact that this meant the complicity of millions of people who went to the zoo and thought that was totally natural.
And paid a ticket, gawked, ate popcorn while looking at these people.
Correct. And threw things at them or insulted them or were sorry for them, you know? I mean, but basically it was a spectacle. It's like a moving picture, like Tarzan has come back with all his jungle mates and they're showing them there, right?
How popular were these?
Extraordinarily popular. In Germany, for instance, they showed them in the Berlin Zoo, and I think it was 150,000 people came in one day to watch people from the Patagonians from Chile, and they drank 40 tons of beer and became incensed because they had been told that these indigenous people were supposed to copulate in public, which wasn't true, and they began stoning them, and the police had to intervene. So that's an idea of sort of what was happening. Now, what I was most interested in was, how do you tell this story? How does the photography relate to that? And so I imagined a young, very innocent American kid who at 14 years old comes down the staircase, and his father is one of the main executives at Polaroid, right? It's 1981.
Is he white, this kid?
He's white. He's a white kid. He's I chose precisely somebody who is totally innocent of these things, or at least knows nothing about this, who has no idea and who is not deserving of anything like that. He comes down, they snap a photograph of him, and instead of his face on the photo, his body's there, there is the face of a young indigenous man who they consider a savage. And for the rest of the next 7 to 8 to 10 years, every time they snap a photo of him, his face disappears and the face of this young man from who knows where appears on there.
Is it just with that camera or all cameras?
All cameras, every camera. And they experiment and they go on and on and on. Now, this ruins his life. It ruins his life because we don't realize how much our lives are involved and dependent, our identity is dependent on the fact that, you know, we don't have no driver's license. We have no identity cards. We have not even false ones, right? Mm-hmm. We can't get anything. There's no way in which you can even go outside. Because, of course, this is a thriller, right? It's a detective story. Also, who is this man? Who is this man who is haunting this young boy? And it's also a love story because it's his wife, his future wife, who's going to help him discover who this person is. And they're going to go off on a sea voyage, like a Jack London or a Herman Melville voyage, to discover the origins of this photograph. What matters in this case is that his life is ruined because he's also scared that a corporation or the government, we also have the mad scientist, right, will kidnap him in the same way in which these other so-called savages were kidnapped and experiment on him. Because this is very valuable. I mean, imagine what a secret weapon this would be for the Defense Department if they could discover what there is in the DNA and the skin of this kid that allows a photograph or some other identity to appear. It's like the Invisible Man meets Frankenstein or something like
that. Especially in this age where so much of our lives are broadcast through social media and alternative media. If you're just joining me, I am talking with Ariel Dorfman about his first novel in 17 years, Darwin's Ghosts. So, Ariel, you are a phenomenal writer, but you also are a person of mixed heritage, European and Latin American ancestry. How did that impact your writing and this character?
Well, in this case, I have tended in most of my work to work with the Chilean connection, the Latin American connection, because that's where my deepest roots are, from Argentina first, but also especially Chile, right? And the revolution of Salvador Allende and the coup against Allende in 1973, September 11th, 1973. We also have our September 11th, right? Mm-hmm. So I tend to work a lot with that, with those characters. And what I wanted to do was to take a typical American kid and subject that child, that unwitting child, to the sort of experience of defenselessness and neglect and being forgotten, oblivion, that most of the human beings on this planet live, right? Mm. Meaning, he is made invisible in the sense he's haunted. And by being haunted by this photograph, he will be unable to live a normal life. I wanted to break his normalcy. And then I wanted him, I mean, that's what the character told me, to detest and hate this third world character who was destroying his life and ruining his paradise, ruining his everyday, normal, wonderful, all-American existence. And the journey he takes is not only a journey in space, meaning he's going to go through the seven seas trying to discover who this person is, and there's work in archives, a detective story and a thriller in one sense, and a ghost story. But it's also a story about, can he begin to understand who this person is? And what does this person want? What does the ghost want of you? Generally, the ghost is, boo, we want to scare you. But what do they want you to do? How do you deal with the fact that he's going to discover that his ancestors, both on the photography side and the kidnapping of the native side, both of these ancestors joined together through mother and father in him? He is the seventh generation of crimes committed. Now, what do you do with that? I mean, how do you look at the past and say, we are responsible for those who have come before us?
On both sides, good and bad.
Absolutely. That's the whole point. The point is, I mean, but the point is, can he talk to the people of the past? Think of this. At this very moment, in 1,000 years from now, nobody will know who we are, right? You and I are here sitting like this, and we'll be long gone. But the people of the future have, in some sense, a responsibility to remember us, if not us personally, us collectively in some way, that we shouldn't be forgotten. There's a lot of pain in the past. And I think that, especially in the case of the United States and of this kid who represents the United States in that sense, unless he deals with that past creatively, forgivingly, understandingly, if he can do that, then there's a model for how we can deal with atrocities in the past. You know, they've just brought this lynching, wonderful memorial about it, right? That Brian Stevenson is doing down in Alabama. So all those atrocities happened. How are we responsible for those, and how do we react in relation to them? What do we do to make sure, the most important thing, those things don't happen again?
So how can the West really atone for the past of imperialism and even what we've done here in the United States with slavery? How can you ever make that right?
Read the book. I'm sorry to put it, no, seriously, in the sense that, of course, there are many things you can do, but the most important thing of all is remember, change things, but also the compassionate imagination. That's why I love literature so much. Because if you can try, you can't become a slave. You know, I don't believe you can. You go into the past and you become a slave, and therefore you understand. I don't think we can really ever understand what that means. There are people today alive who can understand, but most of them don't write novels,
yes,
you know, and are not on your show at this moment, right? But we can always say to ourselves, what does it mean for us to be brothers and sisters of those people, to accompany them in their oblivion, in their death, to bring them back, to make them speak to us in some way that we can then pass on to our own children so there will not be a repetition? Because the only way to really change the past is to change the future. There's no other way of doing it.
I'm struck by that, you know, accompanying them in some ways. If we could talk about the specific characters. Now, you mentioned the boy, Fitzroy, but what about Camilla Wood? Who is she?
Well, Camilla Wood is a crazy, zany, wonderful biology scientist. Mm-hmm. And they're much in love. But the 14th birthday, when he goes to ask her for consolation, instead of her saying, oh, you poor thing, why you, which he's saying, he's whining, right? Why me? Why am I that? She says, who is it and what does he want? And he backs off from her. He says, and then she says, you can count on me. And for 7 years, they don't see each other. And then she comes back and she says, you know what? I have something for your 21st birthday. I have a present for you. And she found the photograph. She knows, she thinks she knows. It's a red herring, in fact. So the fact is that she has spent the last 7 years trying to find out who this stranger is, this visitor, as he's called, right? And so the novel, you could say it moves between the claustrophobia of the room in which he is stuck and the outside world, which is full of memories, photography in particular. You go into the archives and you find out. And one thing leads to the other. That's why I'm saying it's a detective story. Mm. She's a woman detective, but she is trying to find out something that will find out who the criminal is. But the criminals are the ancestors of the man she loves. And that is a way of saving this man she loves, who's now become a man. And she's able then to navigate the shoals and the disturb, and also try to make sure that this mad scientist, I mean it seriously, there is a mad scientist there who has a reason of his own for doing this. Because there's a rumor going around that this is a plague. This hasn't happened only to him. It's happened to certain other select people. And there's a chance that at some point in the future, this is like goes into horror science fiction thing, elephants will begin to take over. Elephants who have been electrocuted here in Coney Island, right? Just right here, here in Brooklyn, right around the corner. An elephant was electrocuted. That elephant has appeared on the face of somebody, on the photograph of somebody.
I see.
So it's as if the past is taking its revenge. But if you see it as revenge only, then you can't do anything with revenge. You
know? So is that Camilla's theory about visual memory? How does that relate?
Her theory of visual memory is very interesting. It's about the fact that she thinks that in our DNA, you know, the DNA transmits trauma. It's been proven with Holocaust victims and proven with lynch victims and proven, in fact, with perpetrators. They transmit to their descendants what they saw, or what they felt, or what they lived. They also traumatize for generations and generations. It's transmitted in the DNA. It changes your DNA if you've killed somebody or if you've suffered torture, for instance. It's in your DNA. You have children. Those children, their DNA will remember it. But I'm going a step further. Camila Woods is going a step further. She's saying, in this memory, it is a DNA, there may be a visual memory. Maybe somebody photographed this stranger who's invading you, who's sending you a message. Let's find out who took that photograph, because his eyes saw that man who was kidnapped. And maybe he transmitted that to you, and that's what's coming into your skin, so it allows it, you know? I mean, it's a crazy idea, but crazy ideas lead to,
it's
I hope,
beautiful and fascinating.
Right. So but the mad scientist also had the same idea, because if we can find out what there is in your DNA that changes your face, what can we do with this? We can create stealth people. All sorts of things can happen, right? Now, it's really not about that. It's really, it's a love story in great measure. It's about the love of these two people, and they're star-crossed lovers as well, because there's a lot of trouble between them. All sorts of accidents happen, and history keeps on intervening in very strange ways. I weave the fact and the fiction, as you say, because this person, this stranger, this native, exists. The photograph exists, and I've stared at it for hours and hours, looking and saying, "Talk to me. Tell me, what
do
you
want?" So
you're
saying that you actually have seen a photograph like this.
It's that photo which finally sent me off. I said, this is it. This is him. He's speaking. Who is he? I don't know who he is. I'm going to find out too. So the novel has this suspense, because I myself don't know what the answer is. So as I'm investigating, Camila's also investigating.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I've been speaking with award-winning writer Ariel Dorfman about his new novel, Darwin's Ghost. Tonight at 7, he'll be reading at the Upper West Side Barnes & Nobles. That's at Broadway at 82nd Street. Thank you.
I'm so glad to have been with you, and thank you for your wonderful questions.